This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Good afternoon. You're tuned to 90.3 Northeast Ohio's NPR News Station.
A little road music from the Cleveland Orchestra. We'll catch up with them in Europe today around noon, hear about a two-year odyssey in search of passion, and a new art space on the Near West Side around noon in about a minute.
90.3 salutes the important work to increase highway work zone safety that's being done at Cleveland State University. Support for 90.3 comes from Akron Children's Hospital.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN, Cleveland. Idea Stream.
It's 12 noon.
In the middle of a hectic workday, I'm betting you've fantasized about chucking it all to hit the open road and just wander, footloose and fancy free. Me too. But for most of us, common sense takes over and we keep on plugging away. Well, today around noon, you'll meet a guy who tossed common sense out the window and took off on an adventure to find his passion. His name is Andrew Harrison, and today around noon, Andrew tells us what else he's found during his two-year odyssey. Plus, we'll catch up with another Andrew on the road, the Cleveland Orchestra's assistant conductor, Andrew Grams. He checks in from Germany to talk about how the orchestra's European tour is unfolding. We'll also paint word pictures of the new Parish Hall Art and Performance Space as we meet its owner and one of its artists. And we'll top off the show with a refreshing musical cocktail from Pink Martini as you stay tuned to around noon on 90.3.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. NASA is delaying the launch of Space Shuttle Atlantis until tomorrow morning. A sensor problem deep inside the shuttle's external fuel tank scrubbed today's attempted liftoff. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
It was a new occurrence of an old problem for NASA. There are four engine cutoff sensors buried deep inside Atlantis's external fuel tank. One failed to work during a routine check after the tank was loaded with propellant. The sensors signaled the shuttle's main computers when fuel is running low. NASA launch director Mike Leinbach broke the news to the astronauts strapped inside the shuttle.
Mission management team has decided that we are no-go for that condition today, so they could execute a 24-hour scrub turnaround, and we'll come back in after we detank and fill it back up tomorrow and see how the sensors behave tomorrow per our written LCC.
LCC is Launch Commit Criteria, or the rules NASA follows before launch. Saturday may be the last day NASA can lift off before waiting until late October. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
At least 16 people, including two American soldiers, are dead following a suicide car bombing in downtown Kabul today. Authorities in Afghanistan say at least 29 other people were wounded. The attacker struck a convoy of military vehicles near the U.S. Embassy just before noon Islamic prayers in Kabul were held. The attack comes as some European nations continue resisting calls to send troops to the volatile southern part of the country. But British Lieutenant General David Richards says the danger is relative.
Nowhere in Afghanistan is 100% safe, and sadly today that has yet again been proved. But it is very safe, and actually statistically you have more risk of losing your life in a car accident in Britain than you do here from a car bomb.
Meanwhile, there has been a series of blasts in a town in western India. The local mayor says 35 people have been killed, dozens injured. Hundreds of police have been rushed into the area. Security's been stepped up across the nation. NPR's Philip Reeves has this from New Delhi.
It happened in the state of Maharashtra, the same state as the city of Mumbai, where 180 people were killed in July by bombs planted in commuter trains. India's Prime Minister, Manmohan Singh, this week warned there would be more attacks. It looks as if his prediction has already come true. This time it was the turn of a town called Malagaon. There seem to have been several blasts, including one in a crowded street outside a mosque shortly after Friday prayers. TV footage shows people, some of them children, scrambling in panic to escape the scene, trampling over blood-drenched bodies lying in the street. The circumstances aren't yet clear, but the town has a mixed Hindu and Muslim population and a long history of sectarian tension. Philip Reeves, NPR News, New Delhi.
Dow's up 36 points at 11,367. This is NPR. Israel has lifted its nearly two-month-long maritime blockade of Lebanon. International forces began moving into the region as part of a UN ceasefire resolution between Israel and Hezbollah militants that took effect earlier this month, rather last month. European warships are patrolling the area to keep out arms shipments to Hezbollah. Israel said it blocked off air and sea access to prevent Syria and Iran from supplying arms to Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon. A judge in Detroit is expected to rule today on whether to order striking public school teachers back to work. Detroit Public Radio's Quinn Kleinfelter has more.
The Detroit Federation of Teachers Union voted overwhelmingly to go on strike after the school district demanded nearly $90 million in wage cuts. Michigan law prohibits public employees from striking, and the school district went to court to request that a judge order the teachers back to work. During day-long testimony yesterday, school officials argued the strike is causing irreparable harm to Detroit, driving thousands of students away from a city that is already losing about 10,000 students annually. That cost Detroit $7,400 of state funding for every pupil lost. The teachers' union counters that the district faces a deficit because of massive mismanagement, leaving Detroit with too little money to buy new school supplies or sometimes even toilet paper. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
An intense manhunt is underway near the New York-Pennsylvania state line for a fugitive recently added to the FBI's 10 most wanted list. They say Ralph Bucky Phillips is accused of shooting three state troopers, one of them fatally. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
From IdeaStream, I'm Lisa Ann Pinkerton, and you're listening to 90.3. Jim Harhay, the Medina County Sheriff's deputy who was shot while responding to a call about a disturbance at a home, told reporters this morning that he feels blessed, like someone was watching over him. Harhay wore a small bandage on the side of his neck a day after he was shot on duty. Doctors say he's lucky because the bullet that wounded him came within an inch of his spinal cord. Officers say Harhay was shot by a Litchfield Township man who is currently hospitalized in critical condition after police returned fire. Today, outside of Pittsburgh, Cleveland Police Detective Jonathan A.J. Schroeder will be buried near his hometown. According to the Plain Dealer, Monroeville, Pennsylvania officers are expecting 2 hours of traffic delays due to the large funeral procession. Schroeder was shot to death last week while enforcing an arrest warrant for a suspect in a rape and aggravated burglary case. Ohio Environmental Protection Agency Director Joe Konchelik announced yesterday that the state will push ahead with cleanup of Lake Erie, with or without federal funds. IdeaStream's Karen Schaefer has more.
The Ohio EPA and other state agencies have put together a list of cleanup projects they intend to tackle in the next few years. The projects grow directly out of the federally directed Great Lakes Restoration Plan, whose $20 billion price tag is yet to be funded by the federal government. Ohio EPA Director Joe Konchelik says the state decided to move ahead because he says the regional plan is in danger of becoming just a document gathering dust on a shelf.
These are projects that are all budgeted for, planned for, and can move directly into implementation. It's not just a series of recommendations of things that, gee, it'd be nice if we could do these things. These are things that are going to actually occur in the next 2 to 3 years.
Projects range from eliminating major sewer overflows to mapping the state's remaining coastal wetlands. Ohio is the first of the Great Lakes states to commit to taking action on cleanup. Konchelik says he hopes other states will follow Ohio's lead. Karen Schaefer, 90.3.
Bond financing for the Cavaliers' new practice facility in Independence has been approved by the Cleveland Cuyahoga County Port Authority today. The Plain Dealer reports the arrangement between the Cavs and the three port authorities totals $21 million in bonds. Until the bonds are paid off, the Cleveland Cuyahoga County Port Authority will own the facility, where excavation has already begun off of Brecksville Road. By next spring, the team hopes to begin practicing there. Ohio voters will definitely get a chance to vote on at least one statewide smoking initiative this fall. Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles has the details.
The Ohio Secretary of State's office has certified the petition signatures for the Smoke-Free Ohio campaign. The group needed nearly 97,000 valid signatures in 44 counties. It turns out the group has more than 114,000 valid signatures in 73 counties. The smoke-free issue is backed by various health groups. If passed, it will ban smoking in all public places, creating a level playing field for all of the state's businesses. There's another group working to put a smoking issue on the ballot. It's backed by tobacco companies, bars, and bowling alleys. It would also create a level playing field, but would do so by overturning local smoking bans while limiting smoking in some public places. There's no word yet on whether that group will have enough valid signatures to make the ballot this fall. Joe Ingles at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
The forecast today calls for sunny skies and a high near 82 degrees. Tonight will be mostly clear and a low around 60. For your weekend, Saturday's highs could be near 75 with a chance of showers in the afternoon, lows around 58 degrees. And Sunday could be cloudy and cool, a high of 71 degrees and a low around 55. I'm Lisa Ann Pinkerton, 90.3.
Support for NPR comes from Wyndham Hill, presenting George Winston's new solo piano album, Gulf Coast Blues and Impressions, a hurricane relief benefit, available at Borders.
Berea Arts Festival presents the 16th annual festival on the banks of beautiful Coe Lake on Sunday, September 10th. Complimentary admission, parking, and shuttle service. Details available at BereaArtsFest.org.
From all corners of the earth, via phone, via internet, it's your chance to have your say.
Natalie joins us from Lebanon and Bernard is in Beirut. Welcome to both of you. Natalie, what about you? Do you have confidence in this? Jerry, who's on the line from Detroit, Michigan. Welcome to the program, Jerry. Kim joins us via the internet. Welcome to the program, Kim. Just share with everyone your own experience over the last year.
BBC World Have Your Say, weekdays at 1 here on 90.3.
You're listening to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and this is the show for Friday, September 8th.
Grab your hair and check behind you. There you go. Now you know. Call out, caught up, and see what runs by.
The Detroit Shoreway neighborhood is an area where artistic minds meet and perform. With the anchor of Cleveland Public Theater at West 65th in Detroit, many artists choose to live, work, and exhibit in this urban atmosphere. Despite the recent murders of local artists Masumi Hayashi and John Jackson, the artistic ambitions of those who live in Ward 17 continue to bloom through the cracks of the concrete. Earlier this year, a new space for artistic expression opened its doors along Detroit Avenue. It hopes to nurture the creative spirit of Cleveland while at the same time attracting national artists to encounter and entertain the audiences of Northeast Ohio. Parish Hall Cleveland is situated a few doors down from CPT, adjacent to the Orthodox Church Theater. Next month, the hall welcomes the musician you're hearing, Richard Buckner, for a concert. While tonight, that same space hosts a gallery opening for a New York artist who works in everything from oil on canvas to Xbox video games. We'll hear from artist Alexander Reyna shortly. But first, joining me now in the studio is the director of the Miller Weitzel Gallery at Parish Hall, Ryan Weitzel. Ryan, thanks for coming and welcome to Around Noon.
Thank you, Dee. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your gallery used to be located down the street on Detroit, and you moved to Parish Hall in April. What about that hall said, come to me?
Well, we were originally down the street in an old speakeasy, actually, and it was a great gallery space, but it was very limited in that it was only a gallery space, being that we would like to have a much wider variety of performances along with the visual art aspect. The hall just made sense, and James Levin offered us a great opportunity to move in there, and you know, it's such a beautiful space, wide open, and just is so much more conducive to doing more things, especially with music and performance.
Is it more than one level?
Actually, it is a basement, too. We have our recording studio there and some artist studios there, as far as painting and silkscreen, stuff like that.
Yeah. Now, the building is a parish hall, as its name suggests.
Yes.
So does that mean anything about the architecture that's sort of unique as well?
Well, it was built in 1926, and it has it's very the floors are similar to a gymnasium, nice wood floors, 18-foot ceilings, and it's a very you can tell it has a lot of history in that it's oldness, but we've kind of spruced it up with new painting, and I think it's very conducive. It has a very good feel to it.
What's the mission of Parish Hall Cleveland? I sort of outlined art and performance and national artists, but is that something that you've written out and said, this is what we're about?
Yeah, one of the big things is having the local scene, artist scene and music scene interact with these national artists and like make it so that the local scene thrives, because as with anything else, the interaction with people from outside of the scene helps internally to make it stronger and better. And it also helps people see that you can be successful being in Cleveland, that there's a lot of opportunities that may not be similar to other places, but those opportunities are a certain amount of freedom in the inexpensive living and the space that is available. And to have artists come in and see that and interact with the local artists so that it grows together.
Yeah, and I would think that ground level interaction is a big draw for artists in this area. Do you feel like you're part of a community in that space of visual artists and performers?
I think so, and that's definitely one of our goals, to make it a community atmosphere and encourage local artists and musicians and performers to be part of it and to join us in a sense.
What kinds of artists and musicians have exhibited and performed so far since earlier this year?
Well, we had another gentleman from New York. That was our first opening. Some local artists, and primarily the visual art has been local thus far. We also had a national, international music group, the Red Crayola, come in.
Red Crayola?
Yes. It's Mayo Thompson is the kind of the head guy there, and they've been around for about 40 years, involved in the avant scene and part of Per Ubu at one point. So it's... And the members that were playing were world famous, nationally famous musicians and visual artists, like members of Tortoise and Steven Prina. So it's nice to meet people like that and see how positive they are and ready to do things like this.
Yeah. You mentioned visual art, and so have I, in sort of a general sense. Do you focus on painting, on sculpture, on all of the above?
Well, primarily it's been... painting so far, but I'm a photographer myself, and we also would like to do more things with moving picture, sculpture. We're open to just about anything. It's just a matter of how it comes together, and we're excited to have Alexander here with us. I actually saw his work in at Spaces about a year ago, and I met him, and he's a pleasure to work with, and I really love his work, so it's...
And you're not just saying that because he's sitting in the studio.
No, I promise.
I like him too.
Well, let's bring Alexander into the conversation. Xanders is what the artist goes by. And we are talking about an exhibition of his work that is on at the Parish Hall, Cleveland. One of the artists, by the way, as we mentioned, who is performing at Parish Hall, is folk singer Richard Buckner, who takes the stage on Friday, October 6th. We'll talk to Xander in just a moment, right after we hear some of Richard Buckner's music. This is Lucky, as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. The music of Richard Buckner, who takes the stage of Parish Hall, Cleveland, Friday, October 6th. You're tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. I'm Dee Perry, and with me in Studio 4 of the Idea Center at Playhouse Square is the director of Parish Hall, Cleveland Gallery, Ryan Weitzel. And joining us now is the visual artist whose work goes on view tonight at Parish Hall, Alexander Reyna. And Xander, thanks for being here and welcome, even though we were pretending you weren't in the studio for the first 10
minutes. It was nice to listen for a while.
Talk about the connection that you made with Ryan that got you into Parish Hall.
You know, it was fairly casual. I met Ryan last year at Spaces, and he sort of had approached me about doing a show. And, you know, I'm fairly prolific, and I make a lot of work. And we sort of went back and forth for a little bit about, you know, what body of work would it be, you know, what would work best in Cleveland. And, you know, sort of just evolved slowly over the course of the year. And for me, a lot of the choices that I make in terms of who I choose to work with has to do a lot with personality and a lot with whether I feel like the person that I'm working with is as motivated and professional about the art practice as I am. And, you know, I just got a really good sense from him, and I got a sense that what he's trying to do here is legitimate for this location and also legitimate for me to be working with him. And so we've just gone from there. And I also like Ryan too, so that works well. So he likes me, I like him.
Yay.
Yeah, right.
Woo!
And now let's all join hands. I wanted to go back to something you said a couple of minutes ago, what would work best for Cleveland, because that comment interests me.
Right.
What does that mean? I mean, how do you decide something like that?
It's actually a little bit of a tricky question, but the gist is this, and this actually goes back to what you guys were talking about before in terms of Ryan being primarily a painting gallery, which I don't actually think that he is per se. I make a lot of work. I make a large variety of work. My work kind of spans everything from video to digital prints to paintings, oil paintings, acrylic paintings, and drawing. So I have a lot of work, and as I said, I'm very prolific with that work. I think in different markets and in different locations across the world and you know, in the United States, and I've sort of showed all over the place at this point, I think certain work fits better there. And so what's really great about the show that we're doing tonight is that I think that this work that I'm showing here tonight actually has never been shown anywhere before. And it feels like it fits a little bit better with where Ryan's background is in terms of I think that he does have a little bit more of an interest in painting and painting as painting. But that's not to say that he's limited to that. And one quick caveat to also go with that final thought is that I think that these notions of painting or drawing or video or all these different sort of separate genres of work, I think we're getting into an era where sort of in a postmodern sense that's starting to break down, and it's okay to do all of those things. And the issue with that is I think for a gallerist, it's going to be increasingly difficult for people like Ryan to be able to – well, they'll have to keep from pigeonholing themselves and saying, oh, I'm a painting gallery. I think the best is I'm a gallery, and yeah. I show art that I like or I support.
Yeah, because I was thinking about you being at Spaces, which right. Covers the waterfront when it comes to all kinds of,
right,
of contemporary
and I showed
art.
Video and painting mm-hmm. there.
Mm-hmm. Let's describe a little bit more in detail what people will see at the Parish Hall Gallery.
Right.
Is there a particular subject matter or theme that you're dealing with or again covering?
Right.
Right.
Okay. Well, there's quick way to sort of describe it. When I was a kid, I had no friends. Sorry story. I hid in the computer room and I hid in the art room because I didn't get picked on or beat up there. This seems to be the story of my adolescence. So my
Many
work
people.
In some way, technically speaking, deals with art and with technology. So those two sort of defining trends. In addition, my parents, my mom is an artist, and my father and my stepmom are anthropologists. My stepfather is also works with computers. So from all of my parents, sort of collectively, I get an interest of art, technology, and culture. So my work deals with those things. In some ways, it's sort of narcissistic culture. It's the things that I'm interested in. In some way, it's media culture. I work with media a lot. So it has to do with sort of contemporary things that we see, things I see on TV, things I see in a movie, things I, you know, do in video games or see in video games, things that interest me, but also things that are available to everyone. So it's sort of just a jumble of what's available and what sticks with me.
Do you, at any given moment, work in a lot of different media? That is, I guess I'm wondering if you sort of flip from piece to piece, or if you put a lot of layers into one piece and then move on.
Right. The way that I kind of work is actually sort of in a vast, never-ending, self-reinforcing circle. So, for instance, right now I'm working on a new body of work for the solo show I'm doing in New York next year, and it's a series that involves painting and video. So as I work on parts for the video, there are elements that sort of come out. These are sort of thematic elements, but also sort of conceptual elements or compositional elements that then go into the paintings. And then I work on the paintings. And, of course, like the colors from the painting will somewhat influence the video. And then I'll be working on the video. I'll be like, oh, that's a great idea for a drawing. So then I'll make a drawing. And then the drawing will go back to the video. And then I'll see something on TV. And I'll be like, He stole that from me, and then I'll take, you know. So it's because right. People in design steal from art all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't mind that, but then I reappropriate what they stole. So it's sort of, again, another big circle. we shouldn't call it stealing. It's appropriation.
Yes. Reinterpretation. Repackaging.
Recontextualization.
Re-sampling.
It's completely protected.
Meanwhile, back at the Ryan.
I'm an entity.
What attracted you, Ryan, to Zander's work?
I really enjoy the – it's busy, and I like that. And it all flows together in a very interesting way. And it makes you look at things, and it makes you look – it's not something that's completely surface. You have to actually sit and look at it and think about what's going on and how the different things that are in the work relate and what it is talking about. So it makes you think. It makes you reflect, which I think is very important for all art, creation, music, you know, et cetera.
As both of you are talking, I'm thinking about young people who grow up with a lot of television, with a lot of computers, with a lot of stimulation. So does your work sort of speak to that sort of sensory overload?
I guess in some ways you could say that, yeah, I think so. But I think more sort of conceptually, my work, it basically roots itself in pop art in a sense, but it doesn't limit itself to that. I see my work as being very middle class in a way because I'm using media primarily, and media is aimed almost completely at the middle class. And of course, the reason that it's aimed at the middle class is because the middle class is people who buy most of the stuff. And so obviously, you know, we want them to look at the stuff. So because of that, my work sort of deals with middle class culture. It's sort of neither kitsch nor avant-garde. It's kind of middle brow. But then at the same time, it's completely idiosyncratic, like I said before. It's what interests me. So it's somewhat incidental that, you know, I like video games, but kids like video games, and I like movies, but kids like movies, and I like things that youth culture also likes. But it's not specifically targeting youth culture.
Yeah, you didn't sit in this studio and say, this will sell. Let
exactly.
me do this.
It's more sort of like in a weird form, it's a form of cultural analysis, but it's also a completely idiosyncratic form of cultural analysis, which basically neutralizes whatever analysis I could make because it's all about me. So
it's circular again.
Exactly. So it's an interesting sort of little pickle to be in.
Yeah. Ryan, what are some of the highlights from the show in your opinion?
I think that first of all, the size of the work, I think, fills the space very nice, which is exciting for me because the shows that we've had so far, while they have filled the space, it hasn't been to this scale. Another thing is that the video in the center works very well. The large piece is a very large piece. I think the show is as strong as a whole. So seeing all these large pieces of work together in this space is very nice.
And they interact with each other.
Well, that's also really important for me too, though, because just from sort of a basic understanding, one piece alone has very little context to understand it. And this is why I was so excited that Ryan gave me this show in a sense, because when you put the work together and you get to see all the parts, you see things that are kind of disturbing sometimes. You see things that are clearly beautiful sometimes. You see things that are abhorrent. You see things that are wonderful. And if you just saw one of those things, you'd have a very hard time understanding what's going on. But if you see it all together, you get a little bit more sense of where I'm aiming at. But go Ryan, because that was great that, you know, he set this up.
So. Go Ryan.
I think the video helps too because it's,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's, there's a lot of going on where it's actually moving and it's a lot like the painting. So it's actually, you know, brings you in where as each would be a frame perhaps, it's
right.
actually.
And that's sort of how I conceptualize it.
I can't wait to see it all in that space. So thank you for whetting our appetite. Really appreciate it. My guests have been Alexander Reyna and Ryan Weitzel of the Miller Weitzel Gallery at Parish Hall, Cleveland. Tonight, Zander's work goes on display at Parish Hall with a run through Saturday, October 7th. And on Friday, October 6th, singer-songwriter Richard Buckner, whom you're hearing in the background, plays Parish Hall. You can find that hall at 6205 Detroit Avenue. And for more information, you can call 216-939-9099. That's 216-939-9099. Or just log on to today's Around Noon program schedule online at WCPN.org. Coming up, we hit the road with internet blogger Andrew Harrison, who's searching American cities to discover who we are and why we do what we do. Plus, a musical mixture from Pink Martini and report from the Cleveland Orchestra on tour. All as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
The story of former Harlem Globetrotter Mel Davis's life was a drama filled with love, heartbreak, fulfilled and ultimately broken dreams. Tune in for Hardwood, the Oscar-winning short film directed by Davis's son Hubert, tonight at 10 on WVIZ PBS Idea Stream.
It's the perfect time to celebrate Fall Fest at the Holden Arboretum. Fall Fest features a variety of family activities, a farmer's market, the magical Green Machine Trail, concerts for adults and children, and staff-led tours. Enjoy lectures and demonstrations with garden ideas for new woody plants. Celebrate the harvest season at Holden Arboretum, Saturday and Sunday, September 16th and 17th. Visit holdenarb.org for details.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN. Idea Stream.
What you say? I say, living in the U.S., we often get that desire to climb into our cars and hit the highway for a road trip. Usually it's a family vacation or a weekend roadie to see your favorite musical act. But for others, hitting the road in America means more. In the spirit of Jack Kerouac and Studs Terkel, Rochester native Andrew Harrison dropped out of his day-to-day job and hopped into his car to search for himself through the stories of others. His daily blog, IamOnTheRoad.com, features interviews with people from all across the country as his odometer racks up miles from coast to coast. Tonight, Andrew's travels bring him to Northeast Ohio, where he'll share stories at Berea High School in a program presented by Angel House. Well, Andrew's parked his ride here at Playhouse Square, and he joins me now in Studio 4 of the Idea Center. Andrew, welcome to Cleveland. It's good to have you here.
Thank you, Dee. It's good to be here.
Describe what kind of work you were doing and how you were living before you took off on this quest.
Okay. I was in sales in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was really living the life that I thought that I wanted. I was on my way to $100,000 a year. I was not working 40 hours to make that money, and I was living right in the heart of downtown, right near all the restaurants and the bars, and I was six blocks from the football stadium, and I thought, I got it made. This is exactly what I want.
And what a lot of other people would want, I'm thinking, too, as you're describing it. So what was wrong with it?
Well, it just didn't feel right. Coming out of college, there wasn't really anything that I was really passionate about. My goal was to make as much money as I could.
So had you studied business in college?
No, I have an undergraduate degree in writing from Arkansas Little Rock, and then I have a master's degree in mass communication from the University of South Carolina. But I didn't know what I wanted to do. My brother was in sales. I saw the money. I saw the time. And that's what
I
went
for. There
you were. Yeah.
And so that was all working out. But at what point did you say that's not enough? I mean, was there some crisis point or just a gradual?
Well, it was a gradual thing. I would be making sales, which means I was making money, but I just wasn't excited. And because I was experienced, I could make more money while putting it forth less effort, because I was better at it. And I would wake up every day and I just was not fired up. I wasn't passionate. I wasn't excited. And I needed to feel that. And I knew other people that had it. And that's really how this idea started. And it just kind of blossomed from there.
So explain what this idea was.
Well, the idea was this. I have the job that I want. Well, but it's not making me happy. So I know that there are people that are happy. I want to go learn from people who have that passion, who have that fire that I don't. How did you get there? what's your advice for me? And I started to interview a couple of people around Charlotte. I loved the advice I was getting. And you talked about a couple of people, Jack Kerouac, Studs Terkel. I said, let's take it on the road and let's see what we can find out. And it has been incredible. It's been amazing.
What did you sold a lot of stuff. You grabbed your savings. You hit the road. What mm-hmm. did you strip down to? What did you decide to travel with?
Okay. My apartment in Charlotte is now in a 10 by 10 storage facility in Charlotte. And so in my car, I have a Hyundai Santa Fe. So I packed that thing up to the gills with clothes, laundry detergent, camping gear, my golf clubs, and really just set out. And that's all I had. It was me and my car. And I had my website, which really helped in networking with people.
A laptop?
I had a laptop. I had a digital camera. I had a video camera so I could document this. And the website has been phenomenal. Just so people ask me, do you get lonely? No, because I have people emailing me all the time saying, Andrew, this is great. This is so cool. And they ask me questions about the people that I've met. And so I don't feel like I'm on the road alone. And
how are you finding the people? You started talking to folks around Charlotte. So did you just at random walk up to a business or a person?
No, that doesn't work that way. People kind of get freaked out.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, this,
why are you
this
asking
what
me
I'm
questions?
Doing. Right. So like if there was somebody that I had heard on the radio or saw on television, I'd call them or I'd email them and say, you know, I really think that you are passionate about what you do. And then I tell them a little bit about my story. And so that was how it started. I was interested either in their industry or by their passion. But then as this thing has grown, now people email me and say, Andrew, I know somebody that you need to interview. And that's how I got to go to NASA and interview an astronaut, to interview the first ever female Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court of Arkansas, the fellow that founded the 401k program, all from people emailing me and saying, I know somebody that you should talk to.
And I'm talking to Andrew Harrison, who is on the road crossing the country, talking about people and their passions. And you're hearing Andrew in our Studio 4 of the Idea Center at Playhouse Square for today's Around Noon. What kinds of questions did you ask people at the beginning, and have they changed as you've been doing this for the last couple of years?
Well, when I first started, it was really about, how did you get here? And that one question
here,
alone.
Here being at this
right,
business that you're
at
doing.
At this job, at this company, or really just more so at this point in your life where you're satisfied. How did you get here? And that one question spurs on so much conversation from that individual. Starting off, you know, maybe I wanted to be this when I was a child and now I'm this, and some of their crossroads. And then I would ask, you know, well, what would your advice be for me? And now I really feel so passionate about what I'm doing, which is sharing all these stories. Now I'm asking more, you know, what would your advice be for other people that are struggling, trying to figure this out? You know, as a society, what can we do to have a more passionate society? Mm-hmm. And everybody has their own philosophy, and I feel like it's my job now. I set out to figure out what my job was going to be. I had no idea. It's still surreal that I'm sitting here staring across from you in a radio
right.
station. And now I feel like it's my job to pass on all this advice.
But I think the reason that you're sitting here is because it strikes a chord to pretty much everyone you can think of to ask the question, what am I doing? Am I happy doing it? Would I find more passion in life somewhere else? And as you are asking those kinds of questions, were there any similarities, any common things, any sort of set of ideas or goals that people touched on?
Well, yeah, each person is different. You know, we all are blessed with different talents and different personalities. And really a common theme throughout all these interviews is people are taking advantage of what they're already born with. And sometimes it's hard to allow yourself to do that, because sometimes we're programmed to go for the more money or for the bigger house or whatever. And if you can really tap into who you are and what really makes you happy, that's going to make you more successful at your job. If you're passionate and if you're talented at it, you're going to excel, because you're going to be working harder and you're going to be working smarter.
You've spoken with a variety of people, butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, the like. You've also spoken with inmates in prisons, jails. What did you learn from them?
I've learned that it's never too late. It's never too late to tap into your passion. You know, you might have made some mistakes in the past, and those mistakes might have put you in jail, or they might not have. But it's not too late to find that passion and to make the change. You could be in jail. You could be the CEO of a company. But it's never too late.
These days, you could be both.
Well, yeah, good point. Good point. But so the inmates really showed me that it's never too late, and you could be locked up in a jail cell, but you still have you. You still have your brain. You still have your heart and your soul. You can still do it.
You've been to a lot of different spots all over the country. Are there particular areas that you sort of have stuck in your mind saying, I've got to go back there when I crisscross again, or maybe when I'm on another kind of journey?
Well, a lot of the places I've been to, the people have been so amazing to me. You know, all these miles, people have put me up in their homes. And it's not like I go and I stay hotel to hotel. You know, that would be not fun to me. It's a lot of the human contact, the human relationships.
And is this the people that you're interviewing? Or
No. A lot of times, again, the website. They see that I'm coming to their city, and they email me and say, if you need a place, you got one. And it is sometimes the people that I interview. But some of the cities I'd love to get back to, Acadia National Park in Maine, Key West, Florida. I interviewed the former mayor of Key West, Florida. Arkansas. And a lot of these places, I used to live in Charlotte in the downtown. Being outside in Mother Nature, it gives you that space and it gives you that time to really reflect and analyze. And you don't know what's going on around there, but when you're outside, your inner being just can kind of be who it wants to be.
You're speaking tonight for Angel House, which sort of makes a space for people in the community to find their passion, perhaps through art. Mm-hmm. Have you dealt with a lot of artists in terms of the conversations that you've had, or no?
Yeah, I've interviewed a few artists, a painter down in Charleston, South Carolina. And you know, they obviously are very tapped into their creative side. And here in Strongsville, where I've been staying at the Angel House, the energy there is just amazing. Just the creative vibe and the peacefulness there. And they have lots of different musicians and artists and coming in there and teaching and taking classes. It's a great experience to be around that type of energy.
So is this your job now? Is this the passion that you found, or is this a step on the way to something else?
Well, my job right now, I feel, is to help other people kind of find their passion and to give them permission to find their passion. And that doesn't necessarily mean you have to quit your job and travel the country and interview people. I mean, you can find your passion wherever you are. But I feel like this is my job right now. And I'm talking at colleges. Since I've been here in the Cleveland area, I went to Kent State, I went to Notre Dame, Cleveland State, University of Akron. So I'm going to be coming back and talking at a few of these colleges.
Great. Yeah. We'll look forward to having you in the area again. Such a pleasure talking with you, and happy trails.
Thank you very much, Steve. Nice meeting you.
My guest has been Andrew Harrison, and he is the author of IAmOnTheRoad.com weblog, which charts his journey across country. Tonight, Andrew shares his experiences from the road talking to Americans about their life choices and passions. And his talk is presented by Angel House Center for Art and Creative Life Change, and it takes place at the Berea High School Auditorium starting at 7. You can find the high school at Bagley and Eastland Roads, and for more information, you can call 440-846-1789. That's 440-846-1789, or just log on to today's Around Noon program schedule online at WCPN.org. Coming up, the Cleveland Orchestra goes international as I talk with regular irregular guest Andrew Grams. And an international act comes to Cleveland as we raise our glasses for Pink Martini. That's as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
You ain't got no money, you just ain't no good.
Well, I guess if you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
That's right, hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more.
What you say?
Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more.
Well,
don't you come back no more.
What you say?
Don't you come back no more.
I didn't understand
you. Don't you come back no more.
Have a comment or question about something you've heard on air? Our website is always available for your feedback. Just drop us a line at comments@wcpn.org or click Talk to Us on our homepage. That's wcpn.org.
The Hospice Institute, education arm of Hospice of the Western Reserve, presents a day-long conference on September 15th that focuses on psychosocial issues near the end of life. The conference will identify issues faced in the journey through this cycle of life and discuss strategies to deal with them for patients, caregivers, and families. Information on the Psychosocial Issues Near the End of Life seminar is available from the Hospice of the Western Reserve at hospicew-r.org.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN. Idea Stream.
It is 17 minutes before 1 o'clock as you stay tuned to around noon. And the Cleveland Orchestra took off for their 2006 European tour last week. And between now and September 15th, they'll be tuning up in a variety of concert halls from Liechtenstein to Italy. This morning, I snagged a few minutes with TCO's assistant conductor, Andrew Grams, at the orchestra's latest stop, Berlin, Germany. And we began by chatting about how the Cleveland's performances went over the weekend at the Lucerne Festival in Switzerland.
Oh, they've all been going just splendidly. The three concerts in Lucerne, Switzerland, were all very, very good and extremely well received. And then we had a concert in a small city, Essen, Germany, which, you know, I was getting the impression that the people attending the concert probably hadn't heard playing and music making of that level in quite some time. There were many, many curtain calls, and Franz actually had to bring the orchestra off with him because we had no encores left, and they just kept asking for more. And now we are here in Berlin. We arrived yesterday, and we have a concert this evening at the Philharmonie, where the Berlin Philharmonic plays, and conductors like Herbert von Karajan, you know, built their reputations on practically, and it'll be very, very interesting to see how that goes.
What's been the adjustment for the orchestra from hall to hall as you sort of tune up before the concerts?
You know, there's generally some sort of, like at least a sound check, a half an hour to an hour, a period of time, maybe an hour or two before the actual concert, where the orchestra and Franz will gather on stage and go through passages of the music that the orchestra plays that night, and just to get an idea of what the hall is like and what adjustments need to be made so that, you know, the music, what, you know, the performance fits the hall, so that the audience gets as consistent an oral picture of the work that we try to deliver.
What's been the highlight for you up to this point?
Highlight.
Yeah, musical highlight or just on the road?
Musically, it was definitely the first concert in Lucerne. We played, the first half was the world premiere of the Roche Commission winner, Hans-Peter Kibritz, his Touché. I've been speaking about it in my tour reports on WCLV, but it's this piece that was written for soprano and tenor and orchestra, and the soprano and tenor basically play a, shall we say, a married couple that has been together a bit too long. And so it's really basically a couple of arguments set to music. So these arguments have a soundtrack, if you will, and very, very interesting piece. But the second half consisted of the Bruckner's Fifth Symphony, which went amazingly well. I'd have to say probably that performance was in my top three concerts I've seen the Cleveland Orchestra do since I've been here, in the 2 years that I've been.
And then there's a concert on stage tonight, as you mentioned, at the Berlin Philharmonie.
At the Philharmonie.
The most challenging piece on that program would be what?
Let's see, well, if I can remember what we're playing tonight.
Oh, let's see, Mozart.
Mozart's Aria Ho.
And Debussy?
And Debussy. Probably the Mozart.
And why?
Is the most challenging. The orchestra is still trying to... Trons and the orchestra are still continually working on that. Well, Mozart requires such a delicacy and a clarity of intention that, you know, Mozart is really the music that can really show, you know, how good an orchestra is musically speaking. I don't know. It's just such a delicate thing. It's like fine crystal. You have to handle it just right.
Or it can shatter.
Or it can shatter. Not that this orchestra would ever let anything shatter. But it's just, you know, Franz has very clear concept of this symphony, the Prague Symphony. And it's just, as he keeps working on it with the orchestra, it gets better and better and better and better.
Excellent. Well, I will let you probably decompress from rehearsal. Is that where we're catching you now?
No, I'm standing in the corner, in a corner of one of the restaurants in the hotel. I'm about to grab a quick bite to eat before I suit up or shower and suit up and get to the hall.
Well, I so appreciate the color commentary for the orchestra, and we look forward to talking with you at the conclusion next week.
Next week, absolutely.
All right, take care, Andrew.
Thank you, Dee.
Cleveland Orchestra Assistant Conductor Andrew Graham speaking with me from the orchestra's European tour, where tonight the orchestra performs in Berlin. Next week, they move on to Linz, Austria for a series of concerts before traveling to Verona, Italy. That's where Andrew joins us from next week as we check in Friday, September 15th on Around Noon. For more on Andrew and the orchestra's European tour, log on to today's Around Noon program schedule online at WCPN.org. Coming up, a musical cocktail that's shaken and stirred as we replay my conversation with the leaders of Pink Martini prior to their performance at the Cleveland Museum of Art this weekend. That's as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3.
In the late 50s, on the albums New Bottle, Old Wine, and Great Jazz Standards, Gil Evans brought new life to a series of well-known pieces, including King Porter Stomp, Struttin' with Some Barbecue, and Round Midnight, by arranging them for jazz orchestra. Evans showcased several brilliant soloists on these dates, including alto player Cannonball Adderley and trumpeter Johnny Coles. They've just been remastered and reissued. We'll feature them Monday night at 9, when we bring you jazz, on 90.3.
You're listening to Around Noon, and just a little additional bit of information about an earlier segment we shared with you with Andrew Harrison speaking at Berea High School, that event co-sponsored by the American Field Service Group, a foreign student exchange group, and in cooperation with Angel House. And once again, that's at Berea High School this evening. This moment, you are tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. Being a true citizen of the world carries a lot of responsibility. You've got to have an open mind, whether it comes to culture, food, people, and in the case of my next guests, music. Since their debut album in 1997, the members of Pink Martini have shaken and stirred their unique musical mix across the country and over various continents. Described by the New Yorker magazine as simply breathtaking, Pink Martini shares their songs in English, French, Italian, Japanese, Greek, and Portuguese, while going gold with their records in France and Greece. This Sunday night, you can join in on the international fun as Pink Martini returns to town for a show at the Cleveland Museum of Art's newly refurbished Gardner Auditorium. A couple of years ago, I had a chance to talk to a pair of the music makers from Pink Martini, Thomas Lauderdale and China Forbes, and I began by asking Thomas how he became a citizen of the musical world.
Well, I think a lot of that really came from my parents. I actually grew up in the neighboring state. I'm a Hoosier, Indiana, and we were certainly an unusual family. There were four children, and all of us are adopted. I have a black brother, a black sister, an Iranian brother, and I'm sort of the mystery Asian of the lot. And this idea of truly being global in scope, I think, really was birthed with my parents. And in terms of music, I grew up studying music of different places and grew up studying languages. And so putting together the band, it really made a lot of sense to explore something beyond English in terms of both rhythm and lyric.
And China, it's often your voice that we hear in those many different languages. Do you have a similar background, or did that multiculturalism come from being part of the group?
Ironically, I am pretty multicultural too, but Thomas had more of the vision of bringing it to the music than I did. My mother's black, my father's white, and he's from French and Scottish ancestry, so I grew up hearing a lot of French spoken by my grandfather and studied French in school. And then when Thomas had me start singing in different languages, French was the first natural choice, and then it expanded. I studied some Italian, and now I'm studying some Spanish, and it's fun to sing in Greek, even though I don't speak it, and Japanese and Croatian. So it's sort of like a really fun school assignment.
Yeah. And it's also obviously fun for a lot of people to listen to. It seems like the group was instantly a hit, even though you hadn't been thinking about putting together a group, I understand, when the very first get-together happened.
That's right.
Let's describe the events that led up to that birth of the group.
Well, it was, you know, I mean, the band sort of started in a political atmosphere, actually. There were some civil rights initiatives going on in the state of Oregon, and I wanted to hire a surf band to open for the Del Rubio triplets, who are these women who were somewhere between the ages of 60 and 70. I first saw them in Pee Wee Herman's Christmas special.
Oh.
And they're literally triplets and from Panama, I believe, actually. And they would wear mini skirts and play guitar and sing covers of 80s songs like Whip It and Walk Like an Egyptian and I Will Survive. And so the surf band I couldn't get a hold of and decided to just put on a cocktail dress and start a band of my own. Can I say that?
I think you just did. And it's a wonderful image, too. But the audience was immediately responsive, from what I understand.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, it's cozy music. Mm-hmm. The music itself is really approachable. It's very melodic. It's very... there's something about it which is just so neighborly, really. I think a lot of current pop music is so indiscernible. You can't really necessarily understand the lyric, and there are maybe not quite so many melodies. And this is really more old-fashioned. It really kind of comes from that sense of a Hollywood musical of the 40s or 50s.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit of No Hay Problema. And that is from Pink Martini, as you stay tuned to Around Noon on 90.3. We are listening to the music of Pink Martini, and in the studio with me, Thomas Lauderdale and China Forbes. And China, the group is fairly large by today's standards. Thomas, I understand, is the driving force, but what are the other contributions of members of the group?
I would say everyone contributes in that we get together and rehearse and workshop new songs that someone has written. Often Thomas and I write, but other members write too. And, you know, Thomas is really open to the ideas of the rhythm section because they really want to play, you know, a variety of the rhythms that they're studying. They go to Brazil camp in the summer, and they're just so very excited about drums. And
you left.
They need, you know, to have that variety. And you know, Thomas and I don't really know that much about it, so we're very open to whatever they want to do. And, you know, everyone comes up with parts for their instrument, and or sometimes Thomas will write the parts. Even I might write a few. But it's really a great group of people. I mean, for such a big band, it's so rare, I think, that everyone gets along as well as they do, especially now. I mean, now more than ever, it's like this big family. Hmm.
Did you all meet at Harvard?
No, just Thomas and I went to Harvard, and he lured me from New York City to come sing in 95, and that sort of it took 3 years for me to commit to moving to Portland.
Yeah, I would fly her back and forth every other weekend for 3 years, and it was always, she racked up a lot of frequent flyer miles.
I sure did. And yeah, so the rest of the band, I think Thomas just found, you know, in the halls and clubs of Portland.
I'm picturing that too.
Hey, want to be in a band?
The streets and cafes.
Yeah, actually, you know, it was very organic in terms of this group of people. We never really sort of, in terms of the people that are in the band right now, it was never really an active search. It just sort of happened. I found actually whenever auditioning people for specific things that it never really worked.
Okay. So it was just a process of, hey, I've got this group going and we're doing some really interesting things, and you would see someone and they'd say, well, that sounds kind of fun.
Exactly. Huh. And there are 10 of us now. And it's really kind of, it is amazing that, you know, in this period of time we've seen record executives of various companies come and go, and whole, like, you know, labels being bought. And it's an amazing thing to have the consistency of this group for really, I think, 5 years.
Thomas Lauderdale and China Forbes from the acclaimed ensemble Pink Martini speaking with me 2 years ago. Pink Martini performs this Sunday night, presented by the Women's Council of the Cleveland Museum of Art. The concert begins at 7, followed by a martini cocktail buffet. Find out more at 216-421-7350. That's 216-421-7350. Or for more on the group, log on to our Around Noon program schedule at WCPN.org.
Hang on to the fun, stay on. You'll be defined.
Funding for the production of Around Noon on 90.3 in part comes from the Coolis Foundation, the John P. Murphy Foundation, the S. Livingston Mather Charitable Trust, Glenmead Trust Company, trustee. Additional support for 90.3 comes from Key Bank. And 90.3 wants you to know about Fenn Academy, an alliance between local companies, high schools, and Cleveland State University that's working to better prepare students for technology-based careers.
Your sunny someday will come one day soon.
You're listening to 90.3 WCPN, Cleveland. Idea Stream.
BBC World News, I'm Mary Small.